So, you know, what is the meaning of life? You know, that's really a very basic, fundamental question. Remember that comic strip BC? Any of you ever read that? You know, there was frequent, you know, examples of, you know, the guy climbing up to the mountain asking the sage on top, what is the meaning of life, you know, or something like that. And so everybody has this question. Everybody's confronted with it. And the thing that, you know, we have to remind ourselves of is that, you know, every answer to that question, what is the meaning of life? Every answer to that question that is not the biblical answer is not going to work. Because this is God's world. And so people who answer the question of what is the meaning of life in other ways are going to butt up against reality at some point. Their view is not going to line up. There's going to be, we've talked about this, there's going to be points of tension where their system of belief does not line up with human experience in God's world. There's just going to be an inconsistency there. So today, what I wanted to do is I wanted to just look at the basic ways you can answer this question. There's not very many, actually. I think I have, five on here. I think there's five. So, five basic answers, you know, and you could parse that differently. Maybe you could make it even less than that or slightly more. But this is one way, I think, of thinking about it and really trying to see where the points of tension are in the non-biblical answers. So that's where we're going today. So we begin just by very briefly looking at the way biblical Christianity answers the question of life's meaning. It begins... how does the Bible begin? In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. It begins with God. God was there before the beginning. So the meaning of the universe is rooted in this one who stands outside the universe. This being who was there before time began and who brought everything that exists into being. And so fundamental to the biblical worldview, the biblical answer to the question of the meaning of life, is this principle of what we could call the creator-creature distinction. There is a distinction between the creator and his creation. And that may seem very fundamental, but it's something actually that gets lost very quickly in other answers to the question of the meaning of life. So because God is the creator of all things, that also means he's the owner of all things. Everything belongs to God. It wouldn't be if it weren't for him. And because of that, God's purpose and not ours is central to the story of the world. God created the world in order to display his glory by establishing his holy rule over a people whom he graciously set apart to be his own. I think that's one way you could encapsulate the Bible's answer to the question, what is the meaning of human existence and what is the meaning of the world? Just very briefly, you know, as you talk with non-Christians and even as you see debates over these kinds of issues, two questions that come up again and again and again, and they're even presented by people who are, you know, very intelligent people, these new atheists, you know, Sam Harris and those Dawkins and these kinds of people. You know, these are very, very intelligent people, and yet they ask some questions that really, when you just analyze them a little bit, you see that they're actually not good questions. One is, okay, you're saying that everything has a cause. So what caused God? You know, and they think that they've got you there with that question. They don't have you because it's not a legitimate question. The question of causation applies to everything except God. You know, at least from the Christian point of view, right? You know, that doesn't prove that we're right about that. But the question doesn't actually apply to God because we believe that God is eternal and that God has an existence that is independent of his creation. And therefore, the question of causation doesn't apply to God. And then the second question, you know, how can you be a rational person and believe in miracles. We know miracles don't exist. They don't happen. They can't happen. And again, this fails to take, you know, the Christian position seriously. If the God of Christianity created the world in an instant out of nothing, then there's nothing that's too difficult for him to do. There's nothing that's impossible for him to do. Well, there actually are some things that are impossible for God to do. And that's another question I think that comes up, like, could God create a rock that's too big for him to lift? You know, you hear these kinds of silly things. No, God can't do anything that goes against his nature. God can't do evil. God can't lie. God can't create a being who's more powerful than himself. God can't cause himself to cease to exist. There are limitations for God, you know? and so you know, that's another objection I think that we can easily put aside. So that's just very briefly, you know, just so we have something to compare against. Really, as was my purpose in setting forth the biblical answer to begin with, and we've really looked at that in a lot of ways in the previous lessons. But are there any questions or points of clarification? Anything? Yes, Justin.
Yeah, the new atheist imperialism that's popped up on the challenge of who made God assumes that only the time-space continuum exists, and that there's nothing outside of the time-space continuum.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, it's materialism. Yeah, it's applying their perspective to Christianity and requiring it to play by their rules, and that's not fair. That's not reasonable. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So that leads to materialism, which is the other one of the other ways of answering the question of meaning. You could call this different names. Some people just say matterism or physicalism or naturalism. But the basic definition of materialism in the philosophical sense here is matter is the only thing that exists. So you remember that TV show, was it called The Cosmos? Is that what it was called? With Carl Sagan, PBS show. You know, always began with him saying, the cosmos is... No, that wasn't it. Was it Nova? Is that what it was called? Nova, yeah. The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be. Here's Richard Dawkins. One of his ways of expressing this: in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, it's interesting to read that, because actually, it just occurred to me, that does sound like something in the Bible. What book of the Bible does that kind of sound like?
Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Yeah. And so, but in Ecclesiastes, you always have to understand that he is talking about, when he talks this way about the world, he's talking about the under the sun world, the world as it appears to us in its fallen condition. There is a sense of futility and randomness even. It appears that way. So, you know, you can at least see some of that. But there's more to the story. And even in Ecclesiastes, there is more to the story than that. But really what Ecclesiastes is saying is, if you deny God, that's what you're left with. So Dawkins actually is right as far as he goes. He denies God, so that's what he's left with. But the question is, are you willing to live in that kind of a world consistently? Are you willing to act out? Are you willing to pursue the rest of your existence, you know, in a way that's really consistent with that way of understanding the world? And I really don't think that most people are. But anyways, this is the view, materialism is the view of most atheists, skeptics, secular humanists, and Marxists. And really, you know, the basic points of tension here, there certainly are others, but if there is no ultimate purpose, then there is no such thing as right and wrong. The only purpose that is left is self-interest. And ultimately, if you follow that through, it leads to nihilism, which nihilism is just describes the philosophy that there is no meaning. There is it's nothingism. The whole story of history is a story about nothing. So another problem, another point of tension is the question, you know, the position that says that matter has existed eternally, it creates a problem for us logically because of what we know about causation in the world. There's, you know, any effect has to have a cause. So, you know, even if you, you know, talk about the Big Bang, you know, and actually, I don't think Christians should be uncomfortable talking about the Big Bang or, you know, those, because in a lot of ways that can fit very nicely with the biblical account of creation. You know, as far as it goes, just the Big Bang in and of itself, God said it and boom, it became, you know, and so. But the thing is, you know, if you have a Big Bang, what caused it? You need a Big Banger, right? That's not for me. That's from Greg Kokel. But so a Big Bang requires a Big Banger. So that's materialism in a nutshell. Any questions or comments on that? Yes?
I was just noticing in your comments that they were very much related to your previous sessions about how a lot of these so-called experts and atheists start with things in their field, but proceed to conclusions about them that are outside of their field.
Sure. Sure. Sure.
Can you elaborate a bit on that a little bit?
No, I think you summed it up well. Yeah, that's. I mean, you definitely see that. Yeah, experts that are, you know, if they're an expert in the field in one of the sciences, you know, to then begin to say to make the claim that matter is eternal. How do you establish that scientifically? So, any other comments or questions on materialism? Yeah, Ernie.
Dawkins would be a perfect example of that. I just looked him up on Wikipedia. He's got a great degree in the natural sciences, but now he's making philosophical claims
right.
That are outside of his expertise.
Right, yeah. Yes, Mike.
Well, Dustin, don't you think this is a natural progression for someone who's not a Christian? Because if you say there is a God, then in our souls live for eternity, then we either in God's family or come under God's judgment. So they have to eventually take this course.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I just finished a biography of H.L. Mencken. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him. He 100 years ago, he was a very well-known name. You would have, you know, everybody knew who H.L. Mencken was. He was a journalist, he was an agnostic. He thought it was silly to be an atheist, but he was an agnostic. But you read his story. And there's a sense of honesty there, but there's also a sense of just real sadness. Just, you know, when his wife, he was married to a woman he married late in life, and she died after just 5 years of marriage. And the way he talks about it, he wishes, he actually says that he wishes he could believe that he would see her again. But he knows he can't. You know, he's just too honest to, you know. But you're left with this. It's really sad, very sad. Yeah. So monism is the next way of answering this question, and that just means oneism. You know, mono. Monism says that, and really, Eastern religions are monistic in general. So monism says that the only thing that really exists is one supreme mind that permeates everything. So it's kind of the opposite of materialism in some ways. In materialism, the only thing that exists is physical matter. In monism, physical matter doesn't really exist. The only thing that really exists is this mind that's not material. It just pervades everything. There's all different kinds of monism. So I want to take a little bit of time to flesh this out. Pantheism, you know, is monistic. Pantheism says everything is divine. So with pantheism, there's no distinction between God and the world. The creator-creature distinction is done away with entirely, because everything that exists is an extension of God. That's pantheism. Now, there's a viewpoint that's a little bit different than that, that's more popular, and it's known by the name panentheism. Panentheism. And so instead of saying everything is God, panentheism says everything is in God, or God is in everything. And that's where you begin to see there could be some confusion, even for Christians, on this one, because that kind of sounds right, doesn't it? You know, in Him we live and move and have our being, you know. But panentheism confuses the creator-creature distinction. And it does so by creating a dependent relationship, not only for the world is contingent and dependent on God, but it also makes God contingent and God dependent on the world in some way or another. There are different versions of panentheism. And basically I'm treating the Christian heresies, or maybe heresy is a little too strong of a word for some of these people, but errors, at least, that Christians or people who would claim to be Christians have made as they've begun to go in a panentheistic direction in some ways. Some versions of panentheism emphasize God's dependence on the world so much so that God is actually coming into being. God is realizing Himself. God is developing and growing through the flow of history. And in the mid-20th century, this began to be developed by theologians that are known as process theologians, that there's this process of development that God is going through Himself as history moves forward. And then kind of offshoots from that was this school that began to develop back, I think maybe in the 1990s, the early 1990s, called open theism. Clark Pinnock, I think, was one of the major proponents of that. And then some other theologians, Wolfhart Pannenberg, Jürgen Moltmann. That type of panentheism is hugely problematic when you're saying that God is coming into being through the flow of history. That I hope we would see that as very problematic. So now there are other versions though that are problematic, but maybe not, you know, in some way they're not as on their face as clearly problematic as what I just described. But they still emphasize the world's dependence on God in such a way that the world kind of ceases to be real. That creaturely actions are really just manifestations of the divine will. And so there is even a dependence on the world from God's end, because God needs the world in order to manifest His glory. And this kind of teaching is actually found in Jonathan Edwards. We certainly hold Jonathan Edwards in high regard, I'm actually going to quote him favorably in the sermon today, so don't worry. I'm not saying he was a heretic. That's why I made that qualification earlier. But one thing to be aware of about Jonathan Edwards is he was a speculative theologian. He did tend to speculate in ways that were questionable. So you want to be careful when you're looking at some of his writings. Some of them, The ones that are more speculative, I think, are the least helpful. And he's influenced, John Piper, heavily influenced by Jonathan Edwards, and Piper, one of his disciples, a guy named Joe Rigney, recently published a book published by Crossway. You know, Crossway, they're the ones who published the ESV, you know, a very solid publisher. But this book is called The Things of Earth, Treasuring God by Enjoying His Gifts. It sounds okay, right? But we'll read a quote from him in just a minute. And then Ann Voskamp would be another example. Her book, 1,000 Gifts, A Dare to Live Fully Right Where You Are. Another author, female author, Tish Harrison Warren, has written a book very similar to Voskamp's. Let me just give you a couple examples, one from Rigney and one just summing up some of the things Voskamp says. But Rigney says, "We are characters in a story that resides in the divine author's mind, with the consequence that the intentions of the divine author and the intentions of the characters mutually indwell each other." That's different than, you know, Orthodox teaching about providence and what we call concurrence or concursus, which the prime biblical example of concurrence would be when Joseph says to his brothers, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. Okay, that's we refer to that as concursus. But I'm not comfortable saying that there's a mutual indwelling there. I think that's problematic. He continues, "Although God remains God and the creatures remain creatures, the characters and all their thoughts, intentions, and actions are the content and product of the author's creative will. Creation exists in God in the same way that an author's story exists in his mind. The story is not to be identified with the author, but the story is in some real sense in the author. The divine presence really is in the created stuff, really in the pizza." I mean, we can identify with that, right? You know, it's, at times it feels like it. You know, this is divine pizza, you know, right? And the wife and the music and the sunset. And that's very similar to the kinds of things Voskamp says in her book. And one of the ways I think you see the panentheistic turn in her is when she talks about evil. She talks about it as if it wasn't real, as if it didn't really exist, as if it's kind of an illusion, because really it's ultimately a good gift from God. And that's not really the way the Bible describes it. I think evil has a real existence. I don't think it's an illusion. So I don't think it's helpful to go down that road. So I just think it's helpful to be aware that there are voices in, you know, even in the Reformed evangelical camp that are moving in this direction, that we should probably be aware that that's probably not the direction we want to go in. So here's a quote from Michael Horton summarizing the problem with this, with panentheism. "Faces insurmountable difficulties from a biblical perspective. Biblical theism affirms that God created the world out of nothing, ex nihilo. The world has no existence apart from God, but it is also not a part of God. Creation is just that, created. It doesn't emanate from God's being, but exists contingently. In other words, not out of necessity, but out of God's freedom and love. Neither divine nor demonic, creation is God's workmanship. Many other doctrines are affected by a rejection of this biblical view of the God-world relation." Let me just pause. We're going to continue talking about monism more in the Eastern forms of monism here in the rest of this section. But I'm going to just pause because we've talked about panentheism for a few minutes. I want to make sure people are clear. Any questions about that or comments? Yes, Justin.
In terms of the monistic viewpoint of monistic worldview, could you explain how this seems to miss the message of the cross? Each of these seems to miss the message, God's message of the cross, because they're saying everything is God, everything is in God, but there's no real kind of. The chink in your armor seems to be the suffering piece.
Yeah, we'll get to that, actually. Yeah, you're right. I think that's the point of tension. Yeah, it's closely related to the point of tension. Yeah. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, Wendy.
Well, Kim, she has used the word trial instead of appeal.
That'd be different. You're right. That would be. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think. I mean, I.
Do you think that's what she meant, or do you just know? And I'm looking at that.
Yeah. I've read the book in its entirety, so you know, I did get the overall sense of it, and I think her intentions are good. I think she wants to help people bear their trials with patience and with faith. But I think that there's some theological problems with the way she talks about it. It's that's actually my summary too. That's not a quote from her book. I got rid of the book after I read it, so I didn't have it on hand to. Yeah, but I didn't give it away. I'll put it that way. I disposed of it. Yes. So yeah, what I'm saying is that she is saying something other than Romans 8:28. Yeah, because you know Paul does say, you know, God causes all things to work together for the good, but that he doesn't say that everything is good. There is such a thing as evil, I think it causes some confusion there, and I think we need to be able. Again, this is where I think we'll butt up against reality, like. I mean, if you're faced with real evil, are you really going to be willing to be consistent with what Voskamp is suggesting? You know, that, well, I know it's not really evil. This is a good gift that I need to embrace from God. You know, it'd be tough if you've really experienced evil. I mean, there's this, we have a sense of right and wrong and justice, and I don't know. So. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I mean, even the story of Joseph, I mean, you know, we can say, we can see after the fact that God used these things to show things, but, you know, we wouldn't necessarily say the actions of the brothers were, you know, justifiable.
Right, yeah, and she's not saying that. She's not saying that people, you know, can say, well, God made me do it. You know, she's not saying that, to be fair, you know, but somebody else has their hand up. Yeah, Mike.
So how do they deal with saying you have a loved one who gets murdered? How do they deal with that? I've been trying to look at this and I can't figure out how they deal with it. Sounds like a whole
other. Yeah, I mean, I think that they would, you know, they would They would fall back on this, you know, that this somehow this is a good gift from God, but there is an element of truth in that, you know, but it's not good in itself. It is evil when people do evil things. It's evil. So I just don't think it's helpful to talk about it in that kind of a way. Always beware of best-selling Christian books. That's my basic motto. Unless it's like a book that's been a bestseller for 500 years, you know, so or more. Yeah. All right. So moving into monism. From more of the Eastern end, the ultimate goal in monism is to find, especially Eastern monism, is to find liberation by being immersed into the universal oneness. And it takes many lifetimes to arrive at that point of enlightenment. So you have reincarnation in play here. You're repeatedly reincarnated to work off your karma. I noticed that there's a new restaurant in town, the Karma Cafe. Have you seen that? Yeah. It looks nice. I don't know. But So karma is the consequences of your past actions. So this is the view of classical Hinduism and Buddhism. Here, the only thing that's real is the impersonal oneness or God. So everything else is an illusion. You and I are illusions. We don't really exist. The world and everything in it is like a dream in the mind of God. God in an impersonal sense, this mind, this one. So, yeah, Brian.
No, I think, therefore I am.
Yeah, that doesn't. Yeah, you're right. Descartes, yeah, doesn't fit in here. Yeah.
Actually, the quote was, "I doubt, therefore I think; I think, therefore I am; I am, therefore God is."
Oh,
that's the quote.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. that's, you know, very basically, obviously, and Hinduism and Buddhism have their differences, and in and of themselves, there are many, many different versions of them, but this is just very basic here. New Age, we're probably much more familiar with this through its popularity. And there's a little bit of a different spin on monism here, because instead of saying that the self is an illusion, the New Age says the self is the one. That really, you are everything. It kind of inverts it. So here's one popular New Age book. If you're ever feeling bad about yourself, read this. Because, boy, it'll make you feel, it'll really swell your head. Listen to this. The earth turns its orbit for you. And notice that you is capitalized. The oceans ebb and flow for you. The birds sing for you. The sun rises and sets for you. Don't we usually insult people by saying these kinds of things? You think the sun rises and sets for you. Yeah, I do. The stars come out for you. Every beautiful thing you see, every wondrous thing you experience is all there for you. Take a look around. None of it can exist without you. No matter who you thought you were, now you know the truth of who you really are. You are the master of the universe. I thought that was He-Man. Remember that guy? You are the heir to the kingdom. You are the perfection of life. And now you know the secret. You've gained this secret knowledge, this key. And now you can immerse yourself into this oneness. Everything can be absorbed into you. So instead of you being absorbed into the one, it's the opposite, the inverse. And one of the things that makes New Age thinking very dangerous is it often will try to co-opt Christianity and use Jesus use Christian terminology. Jesus is presented kind of like a New Age guru, and we need to be very aware of what's going on there. That the New Age thinking is not biblical Christianity. So some basic points of tension with monism, especially the Eastern versions. Since you are God, any ill that befalls you is your own fault. And then probably more significantly, because reality is an illusion, there can't be a problem of evil. There is no evil. There is no good. There's nothing. There's no grace. There's no mercy. There's no forgiveness. There's no love, even. All these things are just illusions. Are people really willing to live consistently out of that worldview? I don't think so, you know. So, any other thoughts on monism? Yeah, Mike?
I was going to say, instead of the illness that befalls you, you could just say, well, then I get to win in Powerball. I mean, you know, it's kind of like flipping it around. You should be able to get all these benefits. I want this guy engaged.
Yeah.
I want this $1 million job. And
yeah. You could see how, you know, prosperity type teaching is also in some ways connected to this sort of thing, you know, like, you know, the power of positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale, you know, and, you know, some of these teachers, even Joel Osteen, you know, that you know, if you just have the right kind of attitude, you can make it happen, kind of, because of the power there that's inherent in that. And, you know, so you see that stuff, you know, in a lot of the prosperity teachers, the health and wealth teachers, Benny Hinn, Joel Osteen, those kinds of guys, and, you know, very problematic. So. All right. Okay. So, non-Christian forms of theism. So here you believe in some kind of personal God. It's not just an impersonal mind, but some kind of a personal God, but he's not the God of the Bible. And some examples of that would be liberal Christianity. I think it's important to understand that's not Christianity. If you ever want to explore that, read J. Gresham Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism, because he makes it very clear. We have it a copy in our library now. Makes it very clear. Liberal Christianity is another religion. It's not Christianity. It's not just one denomination. And the problem is that, of course, that it pervades the denominations. So, and it even, you know, goes beyond Protestantism. It's in Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox thinking too. So it's a different religion. Contemporary Judaism, you know, it's not biblical religion. They've rejected Christ, and Christ is at the heart of both the Old and New Testament. Islam, deism, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness, all non-Christian religions that have some kind of a personal God still. So I think, you know, one way of summing up, one way of kind of bringing all these together, you know, what do they have in common? You know, because they're so different. But actually, the one thing that these other religions have in common is they all are moralistic. They're all moralistic. And what I mean by that is they all believe that those who do good, at least have good intentions, are rewarded by God in the next world. That's the way to eternal life. They're moralistic. And the fundamental problem with that is, and we do have an innate sense of justice, and these religions can't satisfy that because they can't uphold justice. Because the only way that a person can get to heaven is for God to overlook or make light of some of the evil in some people, because nobody perfectly lives up to the standards in all these different religions. Nobody does. So the sense of justice isn't satisfied. You have to have an atonement in order for there to be forgiveness and justice. That's the only way God can be just and the justifier. You have to have an atonement, and those religions don't have one. And then the last example, I just called it apathetic individualism. These other views are kind of more, you know, philosophical. This is more of a practical one, really. And I think this is where a lot of people in our culture are at, basically. When it comes to the question of life's meaning, they don't care. They just don't care. They're too happy to care. They're worried about whether or not Brady's going to get his fifth ring tonight. You know, that's really all that matters, you know. They've embraced relativism, and that's kind of a coping mechanism. You know, it's true for you, but it's not true for me. You know, they haven't really explored it, though. So meaning can only be pursued at an individual level. And the only absolute that's left is personal autonomy, my freedom to do what will make me happy. So the focus here is on the pursuit of material prosperity, pleasure, entertainment, the freedom to create one's own identity. I think, you know, the basic point of tension here is God has placed eternity in the heart of man. The book of Ecclesiastes says that. We do have a sense of transcendence. It's part of being made in the image of God. And we have a hunger and thirst for eternal beauty and significance. I mean, you see this in all kinds of ways. It gets fleshed out in all kinds of... Think of how sports is talked about. You know, in our culture. There's been a real, as sports has become more and more important, and I'm a sports fan, okay, so don't, you know, get me wrong here. I'm a little bitter about the Patriots beating the Steelers, Ed. You know, but think about how much more increased emphasis there is upon greatness, like, and discussions about who's the greatest of all time, who's Hall of Fame worthy. Maybe they've only had 2 years of their career, but they're already having those discussions, you know? Like, is he an elite quarterback or not? You know, like, there's this desire for, you know, we long for transcendence, for meaning and eternal beauty and significance. It's there. And, you know, it's not going to be satisfied if you're not going to dig deeper than just personal autonomy and entertaining your life away. Individualism offers no way of satisfying our innate sense that life continues beyond this world. And so what you're left with at the end of the day is when you are cruelly confronted by death, because everyone is, everyone will be, when that happens, you only have a few choices. You can try to continue to bury your head in the sand and just entertain your life away. Or you can adopt some irrational sentimentalism, which I think is what most people do. And it's really sad. You instead of funerals where people really grapple with death, they have a celebration of life, right? And that's all the more tragic, right? Because if their life was so great, how much more tragic is it that they're gone now? You know, and there's no hope now beyond this life. Oh, that's terrible. But also, you know, you just hear these wishful thinking types of things, you know, like platitudes, you know, the sun is always shining there above the clouds. You know, he's in the happy hunting grounds now. You know, he's whatever, you know. Any basis for that belief? That's just so sad. Or just hedonism. You know, just, you know, get all you can while you're in this world. Or despair. Those are really your only options. And that's pretty sad. So, and that's, you know, that's why, you know, we, out of compassion, you know, we really do want to try to help people to grapple with these things. And present the biblical perspective to them, because there's real hope there. There's just something solid you can get your teeth into compared to this. So, any closing thoughts, comments? Yes, Jenny.
Would you say that in your non-Christian form of theism, that any church that isn't scriptural based?
Yeah, I would say if a church has abandoned the foundation upon which it's built, which is Christ as revealed in Scripture, yeah, it's moving into that direction, or maybe already there. Yeah. Yeah, if they're distorting Scripture, yeah. So, yeah, yeah. Any other thoughts? All right. Well, let me close in prayer.